the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, we talk a lot about American Thanksgiving. You will hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly and Dorothy Gundy. John Russell and Alice Bryant present the lesson, Thanksgiving and English Grammar. Finally, we hear the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
In September 1789, the government of the United States was only a few months old. George Washington was president, the nation's first. Congress was new, too. Some of the early lawmakers came to the president with a question. Would he call for a national Thanksgiving? One aim was to help unify the young country, which was made of the 13 former colonies. Calling a national Thanksgiving would be a way to bring Americans together. But other lawmakers strongly objected to the idea. Critics had two main concerns. First, some saw Thanksgiving as a religious holiday. They noted the president could not use the power of the federal government to urge Americans to follow, or not follow, a religious tradition. Second, opponents of the measure believed the president did not have the right to call a national Thanksgiving. That power belonged to the leader of each state, they said. In the end, Washington did formally call for a national Thanksgiving. It was the country's first presidential proclamation. In it, he called for a national day of public thanksgiving and prayer. He also tried to satisfy opponents of the idea. Melanie Kirkpatrick is the writer of Thanksgiving, the holiday at the heart of the American experience. She explains that Washington sent copies of his proclamation to the leader of each of the 13 states. He asked them to call a national Thanksgiving on the day he had chosen. The president was very well respected, Kirkpatrick notes, and so the state leaders all agreed. In the years that followed, some presidents issued their own proclamations for a day of Thanksgiving. Many others did not. Finally, in 1941, lawmakers in Congress made the fourth Thursday in November a legal holiday. This Thanksgiving, millions of Americans will gather to eat a meal and express their thanks. Their gatherings may echo George Washington's first Thanksgiving proclamation. In it, the first president made a point of declaring that people of all religions should celebrate Thanksgiving. That idea is still important. Almost everyone in the country, including immigrants, observes the holiday in some way. Kirkpatrick says that, for new Americans, the day can be a rite of passage. In her words, the idea is that once you celebrate Thanksgiving, you know you are truly participating in a national festival that cements your position as an American. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Goodbye, Turkey, and say hello to Turkey. Last May, Turkey requested that the United Nations officially recognize its name as Turkey. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said, The word Türkiye represents and expresses the culture, civilization, and values of the Turkish nation in the best way. Erdogan also ordered that Made in Türkiye be used instead of Made in Turkey on exported products. Turkish government agencies also began using Türkiye in official documents. Türkiye is how the country's name is pronounced in Turkish. However, the English version of Turkey has been widely used around the world and even inside Türkiye. In the mid-1980s, then-Prime Minister Turgut Özal tried to change the country's name without success. Some people consider the move part of a push by Turkey, or Türkiye, to distance itself from the bird traditionally served on the Thanksgiving holiday in the United States. Also, some people might feel insulted that the word turkey can be defined as a stupid, foolish person in English dictionaries, including ones from Merriam-Webster and Cambridge. The UN and many international organizations have since used Türkiye in place of Turkey. But it may take some time before people get used to calling the country Türkiye. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Every year around the Thanksgiving holiday, a strange ceremony happens in Washington, D.C. The president stands outside the White House, gives a brief speech, and then officially pardons a turkey. A pardon is a declaration that someone will not be punished. You might be asking yourself, what is the connection between turkeys, Thanksgiving, and grammar? In today's report, we explore what turkeys can teach you about English verbs. In particular, we will show you how Thanksgiving can teach you to use stative verbs. We will also show you the difference between stative and progressive verbs.
The term stative verb refers to a verb that has a stative meaning. In other words, these verbs show or describe conditions or situations that do not do anything but exist. Verbs that commonly have a stative meaning include verbs that show emotional states, such as love and dislike, verbs that describe sense perceptions, such as smell or taste, verbs that show existence, such as seem or look. In the present tense, a verb with a stative meaning is generally used in its simple form. I love turkey, or Americans like turkey, are two examples. Verbs that have stative meanings are generally not used in the progressive tense. So, you will probably not hear a native speaker say, I am loving turkey, or Americans are liking turkey.
Do not fear. We can use our Thanksgiving example to make the point clearer. Imagine you are at an American store. You hear a conversation between a customer and a store employee. The customer wants to buy a turkey that weighs 10 pounds or 4.5 kilograms. Unlike the turkey from the pardoning ceremony, this turkey will have a sad fate, the dinner table. The conversation you hear might go like this.
How much does that turkey weigh?
It weighs 10 pounds.
How much does it cost?
It costs $20.
In the dialogue, you can hear two examples of stative verbs, weigh and cost. The butcher said, "The turkey weighs 10 pounds," and "The turkey costs $20. In both cases, the verbs have a stative meaning. The butcher is describing a condition or situation that simply exists, the weight and cost of the turkey. Now imagine you are eating Thanksgiving dinner with an American family. You might hear any one of the following sentences.
I love turkey.
I dislike turkey.
The turkey smells wonderful.
The food tastes great.
The turkey seems undercooked.
The turkey looks awful.
All these sentences include stative verbs. You might notice that the verbs are also in the simple present form.
So, why would an English speaker not say, "The turkey is seeming undercooked," or "I am disliking turkey"? Susan Conrad and Douglas Biber are two English grammar experts. They say that, in general, English speakers use the progressive tense only when the subject of the verb actively controls the state or action. In addition, English speakers generally use the progressive only when the verb describes an action or state that happens over an extended period of time. So, you would not hear an English speaker say, "The turkey is seeming undercooked," because the subject of the verb, the turkey, does not control its state, being undercooked. For the same reason, you would not hear an English speaker say, "I am disliking turkey," because the verb's subject, I, probably does not have control over the action of disliking turkey. Now, some verbs can have stative and progressive meanings. Consider these examples.
The food tastes good.
The president is tasting the food.
In the first sentence, the food does not control whether it is good or bad. As a result, the verb taste has a stative meaning because it simply describes the condition of the food.
In the second sentence, "The president is tasting the food," the subject of the verb, the president, has control over his action. In addition, the action takes place over an extended period of time. The president must think about tasting food, then raise the food to his mouth, then consider its quality. So, you could say that the verb taste in this example has a progressive meaning.
The next time you are reading or listening to the news, pay special attention to the verbs. Notice when the progressive form is used and when the simple form is used. Then ask yourself why. Does the verb's subject control the action? Does the action occur over an extended period of time? Or does the verb simply describe a condition that exists? If you are still confused about whether you should use a simple or progressive verb in your own conversations, Conrad and Biber have one tip that might help you. They say that in conversations, English speakers use simple verbs around 120 times in every 1,000 words. Progressive verbs are much less common. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. We have been talking about the Compromise of 1850. In September of that year, the United States Congress passed five bills that sought to settle the issue of slavery. All five became law after the president signed them.
Yes, I love everybody. No evil have I done.
Owning another human being was legal in many parts of the U.S. at that time. Most American slaves or their ancestors originally came from Africa. Many slaves worked for white landowners in cotton or tobacco fields. Some, like Phoebe Boyd of Virginia, worked in the family's home.
Had to clean up and set the table, put it in the evening.
That recording comes from the Voices from the Days of Slavery project at the U.S. Library of Congress. Ms. Boyd was speaking in 1935, remembering her childhood as a slave. She said she had to clean up, set the table, carry the food, and afterwards prepare the bed. Harriet Smith of Texas was another former slave. She said in a 1941 recording that she did not go to school.
They don't know nothing about reading and writing. All that I know, the teachers of mine, your master and your missus.
Aunt Harriet, as she was called, said she did not know anything about reading or writing. She said she was taught only to obey the slave owners. Slaves were considered property, like farm animals or furniture. Slave owners could do anything they wanted with their slaves, including separate them from their families, sexually abuse them, hurt, or even kill them. Harriet Smith said her owners treated her well, but she heard about slaves who were mistreated.
Yes, I know times of mistreated people that did, and I hear our folks talking about them hooping, you know, that they had to grease the back to pick the clothes from the back.
Some slaves were beaten so badly, she said, they had to repair the holes in their backs with grease. By 1804, all northern states had banned slavery. But northern whites still did not accept blacks as their equals. And slavery was still legal in southern states for more than half of the 19th century. Slave owners there said they needed slaves to work on large farms or for other economic reasons. But other Americans said slavery was immoral, or that it gave the South the unfair competitive edge of low-cost labor. The Compromise of 1850 attempted to balance the desires of those who supported and those who opposed slavery. Politicians were not the only ones who struggled with the issue of slavery in the United States. Slaves, for example, had been fighting the system for some time. Many slaves resisted their owners in small ways. They broke or hid tools, or they worked slowly or claimed to be sick, even when they were not. A few answered the violence of slavery with violence. They planned, but rarely succeeded, to kill their masters and escape. A man named Nat Turner led one of the best-known slave rebellions. Turner was born in 1800 in the slave state of Virginia. Unlike most slaves, he could read. He also believed that God had given him a special purpose. In 1831, Turner saw what he described as a sign from above. The sign told him it was time to rebel against slavery. He gathered several men and in the middle of the night killed his master and his master's family in their beds. Turner and his men continued to another house and then another. They killed every white person they found. Other slaves saw what was happening and joined Turner. By the end of the raids, 40 blacks had stabbed, beaten, or shot to death an estimated 55 whites. A local white militia moved to stop Turner and his group. Almost all the attackers were captured quickly. Some were killed, others were sold and sent away from their families. But Nat Turner escaped capture. For a month, he hid around his master's farm. Finally, someone found him. Turner was jailed, tried, sentenced, and hanged. After he died, his killers pulled off his skin and removed his head. The historian Henry Louis Gates, Jr., studied Nat Turner's slave rebellion. He wrote that blacks remembered Turner for his personal war against slavery, his violent methods, and his harsh treatment after death. But whites had a different reaction. Frightened white mobs killed another 200 blacks to answer the rebellion. Most of these blacks had no part in the rebellion. After Nat Turner's rebellion, the state of Virginia passed stronger laws to control slaves. The legislation included bans on reading, gathering, and traveling. Even with stronger laws in place, many slaves continued taking huge risks in an effort to win their freedom. From about the end of the 1700s to the middle of the 1800s, thousands escaped slavery on what came to be called the Underground Railroad.
When the sun comes back and the first quail calls.
The Underground Railroad was not a real railroad. It was a group of people, both blacks and whites, who secretly helped slaves escape to the north.
Follow the drink and go.
Members of the Underground Railroad helped slaves leave the places where they lived and worked. These conductors took the escaping slaves to a safe house or business called a station. Station masters hid the escaped slave. Then, at night, a different conductor took him or her to another hiding place farther north. The process was repeated every day and night until the escaped slave was safe in a free state or even in Canada. A black woman named Harriet Tubman was perhaps the most famous conductor on the Underground Railroad. She had been born a slave around 1820. She worked first in a house and then in the fields for an owner in the slave state of Maryland. Harriet Tubman was known for her bravery. One story people told about her happened when she was a teenage girl. An overseer, someone who controlled the slaves in the field, became angry with another slave. He threatened the man with a heavy weight. Young Harriet stepped between the overseer and the other slave. The overseer threw the weight. It hit her in the head. For the rest of her life, Harriet Tubman suffered from the injury. It caused headaches, strange dreams, and, from time to time, made her fall deeply asleep. When Tubman was about 29, she suspected her owner would sell her, so she decided to escape instead. One night, she secretly walked away. She walked over 200 kilometers following the North Star. Eventually, she arrived in the city of Philadelphia in the free state of Pennsylvania. A year later, Tubman returned to Maryland. She helped her sister and her sister's children escape. Then she helped her brother and two other men. She helped her parents, who were over 70 years old, and she helped many others. In all, Tubman made as many as 19 trips to the South. She led about 300 slaves to freedom. Tubman and her passengers were never caught, but if they had been, they would have been severely punished. Former masters were likely to beat or cut off the hands of escaped slaves. The Compromise of 1850 made escaping slavery even harder. One of the bills Congress passed was the Fugitive Slave Act. It said anyone who helped a fugitive, that is, an escaped slave, would be fined. And it said fugitive slaves must be returned to their owner, even if they had escaped to a free state. Fugitive slaves had no right to a trial. Because they could not defend themselves in court, even freed blacks could be kidnapped and enslaved. In 1852, a white woman published a book about slavery. She called it Uncle Tom's Cabin. Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote the book for one reason. She wanted to show how cruel slavery was. Fugitive slaves also published books about their experiences. The stories painted a picture of slavery that most people in the North had never seen. They were shocked. Public pressure to end slavery grew stronger. Anti-slavery activists, called abolitionists, wanted to free all slaves immediately. But even if that could be done, there was the question of what to do with the freed slaves. In many places, it seemed impossible that blacks and whites could live together peacefully and in freedom. The best answer, some people thought, was to free the slaves and help them return to Africa. It was not a new idea. In the early 1800s, a group of leading Americans had formed an organization for that purpose. They called it the American Colonization Society. In 1820, the society began helping to send blacks to Africa.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.